Thank you for visiting Shift Shapers Pole Reversal Radio. You probably came to our podcast site to catch one of our interviews, or you might be here because you know something isn't right with that story they're telling you, that the economy is about to be rescued. Everything will start growing again. Corporations are here to help you. Global trade is good for us. Toxic sludge is good for fish. And oh yes, war is peace. On Shift Shapers, we interview today's thinkers and authors about economic meltdowns, shady military and surveillance programs, climate shock, and fuel shock, also known as peak oil. They give us a true reading of what is in front of us and some clues about how to survive and go forward in an uncertain future. While you're here, browse through our menu of interviews. You'll find Michael C. Rupert, author of Reinventing Collapse, Richard Heinberg, author of The End of Growth, James Howard Kunstler, author of The Long Emergency, Derek Jensen, author of Endgame, Jacques Fresco and Roxanne Meadows of The Venus Project, Guy McPherson, author of Walking Away from Empire, Alex Smith, Radio EcoShock, Mike Sozabee, filmmaker of Somewhere in New Mexico Before the End of Time, Carolyn Baker, author of Sacred Demise, Kathy McMahon, Peak Oil Shrink, Medea Benjamin, Code Pink, Pam Larry of Right to Know and Label GMOs. Also, numerous people involved in the transition, 350.org, alternative currencies, workers' cooperatives, and the Occupy movements. You will even find bilingual postings in Spanish and English. Welcome to Shift Shapers Pole Reversal Radio. Enjoy your podcast. A lot of news has come out of Europe lately about the possibility of a total economic crash of the Eurozone, bringing down one country after another economically. The most recent country to fall under the curse of debt and the curse of austerity has been Spain, with skyrocketing unemployment, a government that has instituted measures to get rid of social safety nets. Somewhere in Spain, in that beleaguered country, is a place called Mondragon, where there is no unemployment, where everybody has health care.
It's the most prosperous area of Spain. There is zero poverty, and it's something that you're hit with as soon as you get to this region. You see no poverty anywhere.
What's different about this place? All the businesses are worker-owned.
Mondragon is out of that system. If they have their own health care, their own pension system, theirs isn't going to dry up, or will there be any austerity in their system? They still have zero unemployment because their commitment is to the worker-owners that are there.
Mondragon has become a magnet for economically minded people to see what can be done to change things over to the worker-owned cooperative model that has made Mondragon so prosperous. One person who's taken the lead in this is Georgia Kelly.
I don't see a bright future for capitalism, and I think what's going to be important here is to have alternatives, enough of them up and running, that there's something to take its place.
Join me, your host, Dana Furbine, for an interview with Georgia Kelly of Praxis Peace Institute on Shift Shapers Wednesday, 5 to 6 p.m. here on KBBF FM 89.1. Here on Shift Shapers Pole Reversal Radio, I'm your host, Daniel Kerbine, and I have on the phone with me Georgia Kelly. She's going to tell you a little bit about herself, but one of the things that has brought me to this interview with her today is her exploration of the worker-owned cooperatives in the Mondragon region of Spain. We're going to learn something about that today. Georgia, thank you for joining us here on Shift Shapers.
Well, thank you for having me.
And the first thing I want to ask you is, what is it that has brought you to this exploration and actually visiting Spain to learn more about what worker co-ops are all about?
Well, it began, I'm actually founder and director of Praxis Peace Institute, which is a Sonoma-based nonprofit peace education organization. And we have been looking, during the last 10 years, we've been exploring what are the pathways to peace. We know what's wrong. We know we have a culture and an economy that really doesn't support peace. It's more aligned with war. So our quest has been, what are the avenues into establishing a culture of peace, a real culture of peace? What would it take? What needs to change? And that's been an ongoing inquiry and exploration, which I don't see any end to. But for the past 4 years, when we did a conference in Sonoma called The Economics of Peace in 2009, our focus has been on the economic avenue to peace. And certainly we spent a lot of time looking at how the kind of economic structures we have support war. So we know that, but then it came to the point, well, what do we do about this? What are some of the models that actually support peace? Can we find them? And that led me to Mondragon, first because they're worker-owned businesses, and they've been around for nearly 60 years,
yeah.
So they have a track record. And there's something that one could see with something that's been around that long that gives it more credibility, I think, to people who want to find out about worker ownership. So I put together a trip of 25 people to go visit and to have a seminar and study tour there. But that actually happened after the director of dissemination at Mondragon spoke at one of our conferences that we held in Europe. So we've been building this relationship for about 5 years. And we've taken 3 groups there to Mondragon for the study tour, and we'll bring a 5th there in this coming September, so just a little over a month.
Where are the people coming from that are joining the groups?
Well, most are from the U.S. We always have a larger contingent from the Bay Area, but we also have people from the East Coast and some other European countries, Canada, Korea, just a mixture. People, some of them are already involved in worker-owned businesses. Some of them are interested in converting their business to worker ownership.
Oh, interesting.
Others are educators. So it's a wide swath of the population represented in these groups.
Very interesting, because there are actually models, that the part that you said about businesses that are interested in converting to worker ownership, and there are some models where a company was, for whatever reason, maybe they weren't as successful as they thought they would be under the model that they had, and the workers bought them out.
That does happen.
I don't know all of the examples, but I'm sure anyone who wanted to look some up could find some.
Yeah, and we do have worker-owned businesses in America.
Uh-huh.
They don't get much press. That's why I think what you're doing with this radio interview and people who do interview those involved with them or write about them, it's very important because they seem to be below the mainstream media completely. They're not getting their due. But we have some in the Bay Area. In fact, in Sonoma County, we have Alvarado Street Bakery, which is
yes.
worker-owned, has been around for over 30 years, and is a highly successful business.
Actually, I've interviewed people that work there.
Oh, you have?
Yeah, I had heard this thing about worker-owned businesses and that there was one in Sonoma County. So I called them to find out about how they do things. And I interviewed...
Or rather, my co-host, Evelina Molina, interviewed...
Somebody who bakes bagels on the bagel
uh-huh.
line and makes... I'm not going to give away all their detail, but they make as much as an executive middle-class person would make.
Well, I do know what they make, and they've been pretty open about it. I mean, I think
yeah.
you know their average salary is around $60,000.
Exactly.
And I don't think there's anything lower, much lower than that. The salaries are fabulous, but that's because of the way the culture's built. The CEO does not get 300 times that salary. You know, he doesn't get 300 times the lowest salary like a lot of corporations do here. So the equation is much, much different. And the money's invested back in the business and in the pension plan and in the health care plans and in the vacation time. So it's a real people-oriented business, which is what worker ownership is about.
Yes. I mean, if you compare the two models where you have somebody at the top, the CEO, making hundreds of times more than even some of the best paid people on
right.
their production line, that there's something really, a lot of income from the company is going to this one person, or maybe a little handful at the top.
Well, and, it's a bad model, you
uh-huh.
know, and I would go so far as to say that there's a certain inevitability about that model emerging in a capitalist system. Once you get to a certain size, that's kind of inevitable. So what we're looking at now are what are the emerging hybrids that could deal with the inequality that we see in the workplace for the scenario kinds of jobs, and how could this be remedied? And certainly worker ownership is a fabulous model. It does require that people who get involved in them invest something of their time and money into, and it does require investing in learning about the model. You don't just get a job there and that's the end of it. You are actually involved. So it requires a level of responsibility that just a day job doesn't require.
Right, and a day job might not even have a path toward that.
No, most day jobs don't.
And that's one of the interesting things, because something you had commented on earlier in this interview was that there's not a whole lot of attention paid to worker-owned businesses, and I'm wondering if maybe there is even, that's part of the agenda of, for instance, the corporate-owned media
and our corporate-owned model everywhere is that, you know, this is very quaint. You know, Alvarado Street Bakery, look at this, how cute, the people own the business, and they're just doing a great job. How nice is that? Now let's go back to, you know, let's get back to the petroleum spill or the, you know, the real work, which is gambling in Wall Street.
Right.
So what you are talking about, in fact, one of your articles in Huffington Post, a blog there, you call it an alternative to cutthroat capitalism.
Right.
And one of the memes that's out there, and I still hear people say it, there is no alternative to the status quo of neoliberal capitalism.
Yeah, well, we certainly can shoot that one down. There definitely is an alternative, and that's why I wrote the article, because I had heard so many people say that too, even people who I thought should know better. But, you know, the lack of imagination in the economic and political spheres is just appalling. And that's part of what I think our educational program is, to educate people about these alternatives. Not only are they nice ideas, but they actually are working on the ground and have a track record over a period of years. With Alvarado Street, it's over 30. With the Arizmendi bakeries in the Bay Area, they've been going, I think, for around 20 years. And they've got six different bakeries that are in Emeryville, Oakland, San Francisco, San Rafael, you know, different cities around the Bay Area. So they're doing very well also. So a lot of these businesses have thrived. And, of course, when a business has workers that are invested at that level, they're really committed to making these things work.
Those are some of the things that people can check out right here in the United States, and we'll get to some more that are examples in the United States, but I'm curious about if somebody were to go to Mondragon, what would they see there?
Well, that's why we've continued to do these trips. We knew we were going to take two, but now we're taking our fourth, and I'm beginning to realize that we have an ongoing relationship there. And it's wonderful going there, because I feel when I've gone, I get a booster shot for coming back to this culture. And also it just gives me the sense of inspiration about what humans are capable of in the right environment. And what we see in Mondragon, what you would see if you come on our seminar and tour, is how the whole thing functions. We go to different businesses and see how they work, and we have lectures by people. They're taking us this year for the first time to their banking headquarters because of the economic mess that's happened, especially in Spain, so that we hear from the people in banking, because Mondragon has their own bank with 380-some branches of that bank that are all over Spain. So they're very successful economically, and their bank has been able to put the money into new businesses and into entrepreneurial projects and products. So in addition to the bank, they also have the largest complex of research and development entities in all of Europe. And
wow.
This is the small, it's like 120 businesses that are all worker-owned and close to 100,000 worker-owners. But they basically have created the largest research and development center in all of Europe. You'd expect that would be in Germany, but it's actually in Mondragon.
Amazing.
25% of the products or services that they will be offering for years don't exist yet.
So you were talking about research and development.
Yes, they have the largest center in all of Europe with 14 separate entities. And they always take us to one of them. Last year they took us to the newest center. They just had added the 14th. Beautiful building, and everything is so pristine, as is that whole area. I mean, it's so well maintained, and, you know, we have all these roads full of potholes. There are no potholes. Every road looks like it was paved yesterday.
Wow.
The maintenance and the attention to this kind of care is really profound.
So how are they able to grow like that?
Slowly. I mean, they've been growing slowly. It hasn't been an overnight thing. They started in the 50s with, I think, three people began the first worker-owned business, and it grew from there. They were making parts, parts for some kind of machinery, and they still do that. They make parts for actually cars, and they make washing machines and pressure cookers and bicycles and computer chips. They do all kinds of things. So they're very diverse in the kinds of businesses that they have. And they've grown slowly. And I think at this point, you know, they say with the economic downturn, their focus has always been to grow more jobs in the area. But right now, their focus is maintaining their jobs.
Now, this was something where if I understand correctly, they were a very poor and pretty much forgotten area of Spain. It was like under the dictator Franco, who just really hated the Basques, and they had no support from the government. And so they had to start something on their own. They weren't going to be able to depend on the government to help them. It starts sounding familiar in a way.
Yes, doesn't it?
It does.
Well, what happened there, and I think it's a very interesting model, and this is where I think what Mayor Gail McLaughlin is doing in Richmond is so important, because she came on our trip 2 years ago and is helping to establish worker-owned businesses in Richmond, which is an area in some ways similar to what the Basque region was like. In the 40s and 50s, the Basque region was the poorest area of Spain. Today, it is, maybe wealthy is the wrong word, but it is the...
Prosperous?
It's the most prosperous area of Spain today. Yes, there is zero poverty. It's something that you're hit with as soon as you get to this region. You see no poverty anywhere and none of the effects of poverty. You know, everything is just in really good condition. And the other thing you don't see, which Americans usually notice within the first day or two that they're there, is you don't see any evidence of great wealth. So what you're looking at are gradations of a middle class. It's not all the same, but it's gradations of a middle class. And that is really interesting, because what you realize as Americans, that we have to, in a sense, give up that myth of great wealth, or that people in the 99% think that somehow all of them have the chance of becoming the 1%. Clearly, that's impossible, and yet there's this idea of American exceptionalism that I think gets on the personal level, that we think, oh, well, we're the one that could be in that 1%.
It's kind of it's an American exceptionalism combined with magical thinking. Someday, I don't want to raise taxes on the rich, because someday I might be rich.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's such a myth, but so many people have bought into it that it's very hard for some Americans to understand that actually what they would have in a place like Mondragon and in the Basque region is so far superior to what we have here in terms of lifestyle, the security in their lives. It's really quite profound.
Very interesting. And when you look at the situation, we take a bigger back off a little bit and see the bigger picture of Europe and how it's handling things economically these days. There's Spain getting clobbered. How is that fitting in the picture? I know you've done a little bit of blogging making a comparison on this. What's your take on it?
I need to do more. I haven't had time because of this book we've been doing. Well, that's a whole other thing.
Oh, a book?
Yeah, we've been doing a book that kind of deconstructs libertarianism and right-wing thinking.
That... Well, may there be many books on that.
Right, we just finished it. So that's been taking a lot of time and attention. But getting back to the economic problems in Spain right now, it's very high unemployment, probably around 25%. And, you know, they're trying to level the austerity measures on people in Spain. Mondragon is out of that system, in a sense. They have their own health care, their own pension system. They have all this in addition to the Spanish one. Theirs isn't going to dry up, or will there be any austerity in their system? And right now, they still have zero unemployment, because their commitment is to the worker owners that are there. So if one business is experiencing a downturn, they will place those workers in another one of their Mondragon businesses.
Yeah, and you're not going to outsource your own job.
No, they don't do that. That's absolutely true. So they work together. I mean, it is a democratically run business. So when they have all this going on in Spain, you know, they have more meetings and figure out, okay, do we need to maybe take less money for a year? And they might agree to that, to help the company and to help themselves stay on track. So they have tough decisions to make, but they make them and they survive and thrive because they're able to make those kinds of decisions when they need to.
Is it because some courses of study are offered that assist the workers and the people who are management so they understand what it is they have there and some of the ways of making the meetings work and making some of the decisions work out, things like that? I mean, they have cooperative learning as well?
Yeah, they do have some instruction where people, you know, because there's a period of time where a new worker owner would be evaluated and see if they're a fit with the business and a fit with the Mondragon cooperatives. So there is that period of time, which I think is a year and a half, and that's when a lot of this would come come forth. Is this really a good fit? Does this person really fit with a democratic workplace? Do they want to be a little more responsible than just going to a job? It's a different level of engagement with work.
Right. It's a very direct level of engagement.
It's a very direct level. They don't have to get super involved. They are required to go to the general meeting once a year, and then from then on, they can get as involved as they want, but each level they go up, they need specific training that's provided by Mondragon. They have a whole training center where people learn more so they can be more engaged. They learn more so they could maybe become a board member of a business there,
mm-hmm.
or manager, or they have their own training programs.
There were people that we spoke to at Alvarado Street, and one of the things that was pretty unanimous, everybody that you speak to there, is that the setup of owner, worker-owned, the concept of worker as owner stimulates and really fosters creativity and innovation.
Yes.
And everyone was in agreement on that.
Yeah, and there's this, I mean, it builds cooperation among everybody instead of that kind of cutthroat competitive, my way or the highway, or I've got to get my way, and that means you don't get yours, you know?
Right.
It's a much different dynamic. I think it's a dynamic that creates a certain amount of happiness in people as well. You know, there's fulfillment in something like that.
Oh, yeah. Immigrants from south of the border, El Salvador, people who actually escaped with their lives to come to the United States, who actually can, and how many can really do this, can actually have the dream of sending their children to college.
Yeah.
Really, seriously.
Mm-hmm. And have their kids in debt forever. Sorry, but that's true.
Yeah, exactly. Well, true. Yeah, and you know, there is a kind of a complex of economic disasters happening right now in the American and global capitalism situation. I mean, you have just some amazing situations of debt, situations of people being exploited. It's quite a picture.
What the whole capitalist system is based on.
How true. The market economy.
You don't have it without debt. If all the debts were paid off, the system would collapse. I mean, it really would. There'd be nothing to it.
Because it's based on banking,
mm-hmm.
which is all about the interest.
And gambling these days.
And gambling and speculating. Speculating is a big piece of it. So, in looking at the situation globally, do you see a bright future economically for the market economy?
Do I see a future for it?
A bright future for it.
Well, I won't answer that quite that way. I don't see a bright future for capitalism. I see it really disintegrating. And I think what's going to be important here is to have models and to have alternatives, enough of them up and running, that there's something to take its place. Otherwise, what I fear could happen at that point is a more of a totalitarian situation where we're forced into kind of a right-wing militaristic situation, which could be very dangerous.
Well, there certainly is the technology and equipment for that.
Absolutely there is. And if the system we have starts falling apart and there's this feeling of we're going to lose control, then it's going to get heavier.
Uh-huh.
And I do think that worker ownership is something that could be just kind of growing up and not even be that noticed.
Right.
But if there's enough of it happening, it can really fill a huge gap as this other part of the economy starts falling apart. And it already has started falling apart. I mean, all the jobs that have been lost, that's only going to continue.
It's kind of interesting because in some ways it's like a revolution as it takes hold, but it doesn't have to be the threat of a revolution. It's revolutionary, though, but it's...
That's what I see, because I think the history of revolutions often are, okay, you change the people in power and you change some things, but you end up with the same problems. So how do you get out of ending up with the same problems and the need for continual revolution? And I think the way you do that is you make systemic change.
Uh-huh.
And to me, something like worker ownership, it really hits at the systemic core economically. It's a radical change. It's not just reacting against a system. It's just too busy to react against the system. It's busy creating the alternative.
Right. And maybe it's more appropriate, rather than revolutionary, to call it transformative.
I think that's a more appropriate word. Absolutely.
Okay.
I think you're right.
And so
the meaning of revolution from Latin is revolve, going around and around and around. So revolution to me does not mean systemic change. It means, okay, you're just turning around another level. The word evolution means moving out. And I think not going in circles like a revolution, but really a moving out. And that moving out to me is creating the alternative models that deal with the systemic problems and just create something that bypasses that system rather than reacts to it.
And that is something where you can see that. And you've been to Mondragon. And
3 times.
We're seeing some things now. I'm hearing about things that have been happening in Cleveland and that
mm-hmm.
larger area.
Right.
So moving over to the United States, what are we looking at as far as some of the worker-owned movement happening here?
Well, I think the Bay Area is a great place for them, and I think more of them are coming up. And I think in the next few years we'll probably see a lot more. To me, well, there's another one over in Oakland that's a very interesting one, Mandela Marketplace, which is, you know, they teach about nutrition, and it's a food store, and it's locally grown foods. Very interesting cooperative there, and one of the directors there came on our trip in 2010 also. Our study groups have actually made waves here in what they've come back and been able to do, and that's what we hope to continue to generate here, is that more people in positions that either in their work or who they're connected to can really start making a difference here.
That would translate into expanding the number of cooperatives and maybe how they are interacting with each other. Could there be, for instance, a nerve center of
Well, that's
such
something
as
that the Arizmendi Association of Bakeries has talked about, because there is a U.S. Federation of Cooperatives based in San Francisco. And the Arizmendi group has talked about creating an umbrella organization like that and maybe even a financial center. So they are looking ahead as to where this could go. And while we're talking, I would like to also mention to people, in case they're interested in going on our study tour, it will be from September 9th to 15th this year, 2012. And the best way to find out the details of it is to go to our website, which is www.praxispeace.org, and that's spelled praxispeace.org, or they could call 707-939-2973. That's our plug.
Great.
And it's a 5-day seminar, 6 nights in the hotel, and we have learning in the daytime and excursions in the early evening and evening.
Terrific. That is something for people to really get an education about what can be and what can happen with worker-owned cooperatives. And we see this sort of growth happening. Now, looking even a little more specifically at a community like Richmond, I would imagine that since there is encouragement in the community, are we seeing some of those sproutings of the worker-owned cooperative businesses getting started there? Are they starting to incubate in some
way? I know one of them is already off the ground. It's a catering company. And I know they've got other ones they're incubating right now, too. I don't know if a second one's opened yet. It may have by now to stay in closer contact. But they're definitely on that track. And Mayor McLaughlin had several meetings after she came back from Mondragon explaining what worker ownership was to the community. And every one of those meetings was just packed with people.
Interesting.
Yeah, so they were really interested in learning about this option.
So that may be a sign of people coming around to that we really need to take a hold of a lot of the economic future ourselves.
Exactly. And one of the things that Mondragon always teaches us, and I think it's really important to look at here, is the first thing you want to do when you're thinking of either creating a product or a service or whatever is, what is needed in this community? What's missing? What's needed? So they want to fill the need rather than just create a product. And that is also a different way of looking at economics. I mean, it's really,
right.
What does the community need? And that's what Gail McLaughlin is doing in Richmond, too, is what's needed here? A bicycle and car repair shop is needed in the community. A grocery store is needed in a community where there isn't any that people could walk to. Things like that. So it's identifying needs and then being able to form around that need.
That's great. Very encouraging. We are talking to Georgia Kelly, one of the founders, right, of Praxis Peace. Where does the name come from for Praxis?
Oh, that's a whole other story.
Okay.
That name came from a journal that used to be published in the old Yugoslavia called Praxis. And what that was, it was a journal put out by people who got together. They were mostly sociologists, economists, philosophers from primarily the University of Belgrade in Serbia and the University of Zagreb in Croatia, who got together and had this yearly annual seminar on an island out there in Croatia where they would discuss the ideas of where's the future of humanity going. And they were primarily socialists, and they were looking at where is socialism evolving to? Where does this need to evolve? What is humanistic socialism and where is it going? Those were their questions. And when I looked at the topics for their seminars every year, I thought, these could be topics of our conferences. And I was very inspired by their inquiry and their interest in the questions and asking the right questions and looking at what the future of humanity was capable of. And that was inspiring to me, and that's why that name.
That's
but it also means the combination of theory and practice.
Wow. And especially considering all that that area of the world has been through.
Yes, since that journal was
yes, since that time, right. And that's people still holding on and going, there's still possible for peace. So you are one of the founders then of Praxis Peace Institute.
Yes.
And also an author with a book coming out. Do you want to reveal the title yet, or are you going to be...
No, I don't think I do publicly yet.
But right.
Yes, we do have a title for it, and I can tell you that it is about examining and kind of deconstructing what the whole libertarian thinking that many people are being seduced by, in pockets anyway, right now,
yes.
Even people in the Occupy movement. So we felt we need to get on this. We need to really talk about it, write about it, and we've been meeting for almost a year dealing with this.
And you, Georgia Kelly, are also really analyzing the politics behind where we are today and also leading study groups and tours to Mondragon so people can see firsthand what worker-owned cooperatives are all about. So very, very busy, quite a contribution. The website is www.praxispeace.org, P-R-A-X-I-S-P-E-A-C-E, of course, .org. And that number again that you gave was 939-2973, correct?
Yes, with the 707 area code.
Area code 707. So, Georgia Kelly, thank you very much for joining us here
well,
on Shift
Daniel.
Shapers.
It's been delightful.
It has very mutually been so.
Thank you.